Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Strategic Farm Marketing, Champaign; KC Summers, Mattoon; and Jarman Center, Tuscola. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
It's 12:37. Partly to mostly cloudy skies were seen across central and southeast Illinois through the morning hours. Temperatures across the area at 11 this morning were ranging from 81 at Effingham to 85 in Bloomington. A weak cool front pushing through the Midwest will bring scattered showers and isolated thunderstorms to portions of Missouri, Iowa, Illinois, and Indiana today. Quiet weather is expected through midweek as a ridge of high pressure builds into the region. High temperatures, they will range from the near 60-degree mark across northern Wisconsin to the mid-80s south of I-70. Overnight lows, they'll range from near 40 across northern Wisconsin to the upper 60s across southern Missouri and western Kentucky. The rest of today around Champaign-Urbana, we're looking for partly sunny skies this afternoon. Isolated showers possible, the high around 88 degrees. Partly cloudy skies tonight. Isolated rain this evening, the low 65. Mostly sunny skies tomorrow morning, then partly sunny with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. The high around 82 degrees and winds up to 10 miles an hour. Partly cloudy Tuesday night with a low of 58 degrees. Wednesday, sunny skies, the high 78. Mostly clear skies Wednesday evening with a low of 62. Thursday, partly cloudy skies, the high 82, the low 65. Friday through Saturday, partly cloudy skies, the high 88 degrees with a low of 68. Right now, temperatures around the area, we're looking at 85 in Danville, 83 in Decatur. Down in Effingham, 82 degrees. 87 in Bloomington, at Willard Airport, 84 degrees, and on Friends Plaza in Urbana, 83 degrees.
WILL programming is made possible by Country Financial Representative Scott Jackson, Village at the Crossing in Champaign, committed to helping Central Illinois families achieve financial security and protect their home, family, and property since 1990. Online at scottjacksonfinancial.com.
It's 12:39. The Illinois Pollution Control Board found that the coal mining industry in western Illinois violated its water pollution permit more than 600 times. Today, we start a three-part series to examine the violations, why the state took so long to begin legal action, and why, despite all the violations, the state renewed the mine's permit. Illinois Public Radio's Scott Stuntz begins this series by taking us to the mine.
Kim Sedgwick drives me along the outskirts of the mine. Years ago, Sedgwick and her fiancé decided to build their dream house not far from the mine on Grindstone Creek. One day, canoeing up the creek, they found a heron rookery. They were so afraid for it, they didn't tell anybody about it. In 2002, they became scared when they heard the mine was expanding toward that area. So they wrote a letter.
The one letter was basically when you see the ad in the paper saying if anybody has concerns, you can request a public hearing. And so that's what we did. And from there, it led to dozens of meetings and hearings and talking to professors and biologists and ornithologists. Do you want to stop here?
Yeah, so this is Grindstone?
This is Grindstone.
Sure. We pull onto a narrow, paved two-lane road and stop on an old concrete bridge over the creek.
It was devastating to watch. So actually, right down here is where we saw, this used to be massive forest over here. And
on the right side of the road?
Yes. All the way to the county line was all forest. And we watched that disappear, and then it became scary.
It's into Grindstone Creek that the Springfield Coal Company and its predecessor, Freeman United, poured runoff. The mine was licensed to do that, but it had to keep pollutants in that water under certain levels. It failed to do that, and that's what led to the 640 violations cited by the Illinois Pollution Control Board. The way Illinois environmental regulations work, in short, is that companies collect data themselves and send that information to the state. If the state finds a problem, it sends a violation notice to the company. If the problem isn't fixed, the company and state can establish an agreement to fix the issue. If it's still not fixed, then the EPA refers the case to the Attorney General's office. In the industry case, though, the Attorney General didn't initially take action until environmental groups stepped in.
We review the permit compliance of Illinois permits and other Midwestern states from time to time, and just to see how things are going. And this case jumped out as a situation where it seemed like a lot was going wrong with the discharges.
That's Jessica Dexter, a lawyer with the Environmental Law and Policy Center. She represented her group as well as several other environmental groups in the case.
So we filed what's called a 60-day notice of our intent to bring a citizen suit against the mine for failing to comply with the terms of its permit.
That prompted the AG's office to launch a suit. In a written statement, the Attorney General's office said it did receive a referral from the EPA, but by that time, it was already filing the suit because of the environmental groups. Dexter says she combed through the records the mine sent to the EPA. She looked at 80 months of data and found violations in 79 of them.
There were years of violation that the IEPA knew about before it did anything about the mine, and there were never conversations about how do we meet all of the permit terms at all of the outfalls.
Documents from the EPA show a total of 47 violations at the mine during that time frame. Dexter, looking at the same data, found 640. And on at least two occasions, the EPA sent letters to the companies saying the agency felt that all of the problems had been fixed. Andrew Mason is a spokesman for the Illinois EPA.
I mean, we follow our own process. We do this all the time. And I mean, if it's not the Environmental Law and Policy Center that's got a problem with something, then it's a local government that's got a problem, or it's a legislator that's got a problem. Or I mean, there are a lot of outside actors that care passionately about the environment, we love the advocates. But at some point, we just have to focus on our own process and figure out what we think is best under the law.
Back at the mine, Kim Sedgwick leads me across a wide, empty field that used to be forest. She says after two failed attempts at replanting a section of the woods, the company is trying again.
So now they did it the third time. So I'm a little impressed that they did it. And they're also using the native trees that we requested at all our public hearings, that all the environmentally concerned people stress. Before they were doing anything that was the cheapest, you know, locust and all that. And now they're doing the hardwoods. You know, maybe we did make somewhat of a difference, even though we couldn't save the original forest. So, it's good for people to speak up.
Sedgwick says the herons still seem to be thriving and that she is pushing the Illinois Pollution Control Board to compel the coal company to donate the land the rookery sits on to a land preservation conservancy. In addition, Springfield and Freeman Coal faced $65 million in fines for their water pollution violations. That amounts to about $10,000 for every day the permit was violated. The board is set to rule on what the specific penalties will be and how much the companies actually will pay in August. I'm Scott Stuntz.
It's 12:45. In northern Lake Michigan, explorers are stepping up their effort to find a ship that sank in 1679. French and American archaeologists are on the lake looking for a ship sailed by the French explorer Robert de La Salle. So far, the excavation has uncovered a wooden beam that looks like the mast of a ship. Peter Payette of Interlochen Public Radio has more.
Shipwreck hunting in the Great Lakes is not very glamorous. There's no gold bullion on these wrecks. Ships on the Great Lakes mostly moved people and commodities, like beaver pelts and iron ore. Ken Verana is managing this project and has worked on these waters for decades.
We call it, this is a blue-collar, working-class collection of vessels.
So history is the treasure, and among the most fabled wrecks is the Griffin, the first European ship ever to sail the Upper Lakes. Its whereabouts have been a mystery for more than 340 years. Steve Liebert, who lives in Virginia, thinks he just might have solved that mystery. He's spent more than three decades, most of his adult life, searching for the Griffin. And in 2001, Liebert found a beam of wood sticking out of the bottom of Lake Michigan with a few wooden pegs on it. The story of that discovery isn't very glamorous either. Liebert says he couldn't see very much at all and was even having trouble reading his air gauge.
When I looked down to try to read it, all of a sudden I bumped right into it and actually knocked my face mask off.
Liebert's team, Great Lakes Exploration Group, fought in court for almost a decade to hang on to his claim to the site. Last month, a permit was finally issued so the excavation could begin, and this week, Liebert's dream came true. French archaeologists are in Michigan to see the timber Steve Liebert found. The director of underwater archaeology in France, Michel Lure, is among them. From the deck of the fishing boat Proud Maid, he and another researcher plunged into the 50-degree water of Lake Michigan to have a look.
Moore says it feels like the beam is attached to something. He says you can move it, but not very much.
Either this timber is very deeply cemented in the sedimentation of the lake, or is connected to another structure, I don't know what.
A team of divers is excavating a test pit alongside the timber. Last night, the pit showed that the timber is at least 18 feet long. Luer says the woodwork is typical of vessels from that era, but that doesn't yet tell them much. The ship's hull, if there is one down there, will tell them much more.
It's more probably not only details about the shipbuilding, but about some artifacts which can be conserved in the hull. And in association between the artifacts and shipbuilding, we can be sure of the origin of the ship. But at the moment, we have nothing of that.
The Griffin was a symbol of France's ambitions in North America. Robert de La Salle was sent by Louis XIV to build a fort at the mouth of the Mississippi River, and the ship was built to support that mission. Rich Gross is a historian who's worked with Great Lakes exploration. He says the king wanted to keep the British out of the Mississippi River basin.
So the English were, at that time, pretty much sealed off east of the Appalachian Mountains. If they had come over the mountains and started trading with the Indians, there goes the supply of furs, and the entire economy of New France was based on the fur trade.
The Griffin sank on its first voyage, and the fort was never built. If found, the ship would belong to France, and divers will continue today to dredge the site at the bottom of Lake Michigan, where they think it came to rest. For NPR News, I'm Peter Payette in Fairport, Michigan.
WILL programs are made possible by Hendrick House, providing housing and food service to University of Illinois students for 64 years. Hendrick House works to ensure a quiet environment for study and relaxation. More information is available at 365-8000 or at hendrickhouse.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 17th of June, 2013. On this day in 1885, the Statue of Liberty arrived in New York Harbor on board the French frigate Isere, a gift from France to the United States to commemorate the centennial and the friendship between the two countries that began during the American Revolution. The statue arrived in 350 individual pieces and would not be erected for another 4 months. It's the birthday of novelist and journalist John Hersey, born in China to missionary parents. Graduated from Yale, served as a foreign correspondent for Life and Time. He was commissioned by The New Yorker to write a piece on the aftermath of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima in 1945. He structured his reporting around personal narratives, focusing on the experiences of six people living there at the time of the explosion. When it hit newsstands in August of 1946, it sold out immediately and was published as Hiroshima soon after. And it's the birthday of poet Ron Padgett, born in Tulsa. When he was growing up in Oklahoma, a dry state back then, his father made a living as a bootlegger. Padgett read voraciously as a child, began jotting down poems in spiral notebooks when he was only 13. He went to Columbia University and studied at the Sorbonne in France on a Fulbright scholarship. His poetry collections include Tulsa Kid, Poems I Guess I Wrote, Great Balls of Fire, and How to Be Perfect. And it's the birthday of the composer Igor Stravinsky, born in Russia, 1882. His first major success as a composer was a ballet based on a Russian folktale called The Firebird. Wildly popular, he traveled all over to conduct The Firebird. Then he got an idea for a ballet about a pagan ritual in which a virgin would be sacrificed to the gods by dancing herself to death. Stravinsky composed the piece on a piano in a rented cottage, and a boy walking outside his window kept shouting up at him that the chords were all wrong. He titled the piece The Rite of Spring. At its premiere in 1913 in Paris, the audience broke out into a riot when the music and dancing turned harsh and dissonant. Police came to calm the chaos. Stravinsky left his seat in disgust, but the performance continued for 33 more minutes, and he became recognized ultimately as one of the most famous composers in the world and the founder of modern music. And here's a poem by Ron Paget, The Swiss Family Robinson. I never quite understood who the Swiss Family Robinson were. The inversion of their name confused me at an early age, just as the name of Mary Baker Eddy sounded as though she started out as a woman and turned into a guy named Eddie. At Walt Disney World, there is an attraction called Swiss Family Robinson that involves a treehouse, so I assume they lived in a tree. Why they did, I don't know.